Hello and welcome to Brokenomics. Now, in this episode, I thought I'd do something different because I've been talking about the Iran war a lot. We're going to talk about the wider region as it is affected by the Iran war. And to help me with that, I've got our geopolitics expert, Firas Moudad. Thank you for coming on.
My pleasure, always.
Thank you. So, first caveat, this is being recorded on whatever it is, Thursday morning.
Mm-hmm.
Goes out on Tuesday. So it's vaguely possible that over the weekend it all gets wrapped up, goes in the win column for somebody,
mm-hmm.
and it's all behind us. I feel fairly safe dedicating an hour of mine and yours time and a couple of hours of the editors on the assumption that it probably won't be.
Yeah.
There is some interesting news, though. Apparently, Qatar have paid $6 billion in order to be able to traverse the straits.
I think that that's credible, but too low, honestly.
Yes. The other thing that gets me is it's just money. It's not, and we will remove U.S. bases.
Yes, exactly.
Hmm.
The Qataris have been making noises about neutralizing themselves from this war, which presupposes the removal of the Hodeid airbase.
Hmm.
The problem with that is that's the only guarantee of Qatari independence. In 1997, the Saudis almost invaded. In 2017, the Saudis and the Emiratis almost invaded. And the reason that base exists is to prevent that eventuality. Mm-hmm. And so that's a problem for Qatar. And in terms of the $6 billion, the Qataris reportedly, allegedly,
mm-hmm.
paid $1 billion in 2015 to a group of Iraqi militias who had kidnapped 28 Qatari princes. They were hunting in Iraq, and the Iraqi militias found them. And the Qataris say that they paid money to the Iraqi government. The militias say the money went to them. Nobody really knows. But opening the Strait of Hormuz is worth considerably more than $6 billion.
Well, I would have thought it's worth more than payment. Six lots of 28 princes. I mean, is it not the case that if the Gulf states don't open the straits, not only does oil not go out, but food doesn't come in?
Yes.
So this is an existential crisis, because it's all very well worrying about the Iranians. That's one problem. But worrying about a couple of million of your citizens watching their children starve is a whole other level of problems for the leadership.
So
of
we're
these
not there yet. And the way that it's working is that the Iranians are charging fees for ships to go through the strait. And they're giving them safe passage through an alternative pathway, which goes between the Iranian islands.
Yes.
Suggesting that the main international waterway is mined. And they've turned back one ship recently, a couple of days ago or yesterday, whereby the ship hadn't properly paid, whereas other ships are paying up to $2 million per passage.
And I hear they're paying it in yuan.
And they're paying it in yuan, meaning that the Chinese are exchanging favors with the Iranians, getting more yuan into Iran, and the Iranians would use that money to buy equipment from China, which is already providing Iran with either them or the Russians, or probably both. But Iranian missiles have been plugged into Baidu, the Chinese equivalent of GPS,
mm-hmm.
which is upgrading itself to become equivalent to Starlink, or the Chinese have other technologies that are trying to mimic Starlink,
mm-hmm.
and Starshield, which is the military arm of Starlink that has the constant surveillance pretty much all over the globe.
And is what you're hinting at targeting?
Yes.
Right.
What I'm saying is that the Chinese are helping the Iranians with targeting and with intelligence collection, as are probably the Russians.
Hmm. Frankly, I'm not surprised about the Russians, because the Americans have been helping the Ukrainians with targeting. So why wouldn't they do that? So one of the things I think you said on a recent Real Politics that was very interesting was that the Gulf states mm-hmm. quite deliberately maintain a subsized military, because they are afraid that if they had a large military, that could replace the leadership of these countries.
Yes.
So these countries are now in a very awkward position, but they need the Americans because that's their security guarantee. That's how they manage to be in the position where they can go on, 28 of them at a time could go on a hunting trip in Iraq, and they have the resources to spend $1 billion to get them back and all the other luxuries that I'm sure mm-hmm. these Gulf state leaders have. But if they're now paying tribute to the Iranians, that suggests to me that the Iranians are at least emerging as the regional hegemon. And how do they get their head around having two sets of patrons?
That's the real problem that they've always faced. And the way that they've addressed it in the past was, for example, with the Qataris having decent relations with the Iranians and being mediators and all of that. The Omanis doing something similar. The UAE has always facilitated trade for Iran and helped them evade sanctions because they know that when push comes to shove, the Iranians can start blowing up their ships, essentially. As they did in 2018, they attacked a bunch of ships off the coast of Oman. And then the UAE sends a maritime delegation to discuss shared security interests, meaning that they've accepted that, okay, we have to listen to you. And the Iranians now are no longer satisfied with letting these guys have this two-way relationship. And they're trying to make them choose. But all of the military infrastructure in the Gulf is American. There are some Chinese assets here and there, like the Saudi ballistic missile program is largely Chinese and so on. But the bulk of the military is American. And especially the Air Force, it's either American or, in the UAE's case, it's half French as well.
Yes.
And the UAE has a strong military relationship with the French as well.
Okay, but for a long time, there was no alternative to the Americans if you wanted to have a very high level, very credible level of security for your nations. Chinese technology, weapon systems, tech, all the rest of it, financial resources, Russian military capability, it does start to look like there is an emerging alternative to the Americans.
Which is why getting into this war was such a stupid idea. Because now...
For the Americans.
For the Americans.
Yes.
Because now, if this war ends on Saturday, as is being rumored...
So what's the scenario in which it ends on Saturday?
Whereby Trump decides, I've accomplished what I wanted to achieve, and I'm leaving.
But that would leave Iran as the pretty much uncontested hegemon of the region. If Americans leave with the straits under Iranian control, will they call the shots now?
Yes.
That is about as dire as you can get for the petrodollar system, and even in time, the dollar reserve system.
Yes. Essentially.
Right.
So now that he's gotten himself into this war, now that Trump has gotten himself into this war, getting out of it is so much harder.
So let's just carry on thinking through the Gulf states. How do they feel about that? What is their temperament likely to be? I mean, first of all, can we even assume that we can just say the Gulf states?
No.
Or does Oman have radically different opinion on this to, say, Saudi and Qatar? How do they work through this group? We're in a situation where we may be losing the US as a patron, as the hegemon, and we might be getting it replaced with Iranian, which is essentially a proxy for Russia and China.
So the problem that they face is that most of the purchases of Gulf oil go to Asia.
Yes.
With China being the largest buyer in Asia. So that's one massive problem that they have. The second problem that they have is that the Saudis have their own regional pretensions and regional ambitions and don't want to be playing second fiddle to the Iranians.
Is that credible given the earlier point about them not having much in the way of a military because they've outsourced that?
In terms of the Air Force, the Yemen war forced the Saudis to upgrade their Air Force. In terms of ground forces, they are quite weak, I would say, with a lot of American equipment, but a huge amount of incompetence. And you're not allowed to actually make decisions unless you're of the royal family. And so there is this integration between the royal family and the military, which they've used to try to control the army. But this hasn't in the past stopped other monarchies from being overthrown by lower levels of the military who have had enough, essentially. And so if these guys actually commit their military and depend on it, the military becomes quite powerful.
Yes.
And a country like Saudi Arabia, which is named after the family.
The House of Saud.
The House of Saud, exactly, runs into big problems there. And with the rest of these countries, these are compromises between the ruling family and a bunch of other leading families. That's how they exist, essentially.
If Saudi Arabia wakes up its potential because it's big and it's rich, if somehow it wakes up its potential, I don't know how it does that, Chinese tech, Russians come in and train an army of 4 million or whatever this scenario looks like, do the rest of the Gulf states stay independent?
No. Essentially, they get divided between Iran and Saudi Arabia.
Okay.
And a country like Kuwait, for example, ceases to exist. Because for the Iranians, the big security challenge is always a land invasion from Iraq, which is where Iran is flat, and the flatlands that terminate near the Iranian-Iraqi border are also where the Iranian oil is concentrated.
Yes. Well, and Kuwait sits on that bit. Well, but that is the live bit. That's the flat oil bit.
So that region from Kuwait to Basra to Khuzestan is largely flat,
okay,
and is massive in terms of its oil resources, and it terminates on the Saudi border with a shared region between Saudi Arabia and Kuwait.
Yes,
and so for the Iranians, the security imperative is to seize all of this. But if they seize all of this, that gets them at the border of the Eastern Province, which is where the Saudi oil is, which is largely Shia. And that is right next to Bahrain, which is also largely Shia.
And so, is it as simple as saying, if you're Shia, you're going to be far more sympathetic to Iran?
Yes. It really, I mean, there are always exceptions to every rule, but the rule is the rule, regardless of the exceptions. And so the emergence of Iran as a hegemon, it changes the political dynamics in the whole region, because it means that at least two of these countries no longer need to exist in their current form, Kuwait and Bahrain. And that's a massive problem, because the entirety of the American policy in the Gulf is predicated on keeping these small countries independent so that there isn't this massive concentration of oil wealth in one set of hands. And the importance of keeping Saudi Arabia on side for the Americans is to make sure that the biggest player in oil exports isn't beholden to powers that are hostile to the United States.
Well, and Saudi has always had a sort of special position. When the petrodollar was getting set up, the US went to the Saudis and said, look, we give you security guarantees and we're cooperating. We will make sure you remain in power forever.
The Roosevelt and Saud meeting.
Yes. But you will sell in dollars. Nobody else got a deal quite that good. The deal for everybody else looked closer to, well, we'll be nice to you or we'll invade you. So
yes.
Saudi has always had a special role. So let's just think this through. If this goes as badly as it could do, so the doomsday scenario for the US, Iran gets Kuwait and Iraq, Saudi gets everything else.
Assuming the Saudi military doesn't break.
Yes.
And if they activate their air forces, well, their base defenses are weaker than those of the Americans, even though the bases are shared. And as the interceptors run out, you have that scenario of what you're seeing in Ukraine, which is sending big waves of drones to disable aircraft. And if you're Russia, you want that, because then this OPEC plus configuration, which is OPEC including Russia and others, essentially is the energy hegemon of the world and is an energy hegemon that can challenge China as well as the West. Because you're not dealing with Iranian oil anymore. You're dealing with Iranian, Iraqi, and Kuwaiti oil as one, which is a game changer. The Kuwaitis, I think, produce around 3 or 4 million barrels a day. The Iraqis, 3 or 4, but with the potential for much more. And the Iranians, 3 and change. So suddenly, you have Saudi that is pumping around 9 million barrels a day in stable times with a total capacity of 12 million. suddenly you have another Iran and Russia aligned Saudi with its own 9 million barrels a day and with the potential for 15. If you look at the actual size of the resources, the Iranians were producing 6 million barrels a day in the days of the Shah. But the sanctions and the chaos and all of that brought that down to under 4.
Yeah.
Well, one of the effects of this war is the breakdown of the sanctions regime.
Mm.
Especially if it really goes badly and the Americans withdraw. But what that points to is the inability of the Americans to withdraw. And now that they are in the war, they have to stay in it.
Well, I mean, this is the huge conundrum. They cannot afford to have a bad outcome from this.
But it was
getting
always
a good outcome could involve a lot of American lives.
Unfortunately.
Indeed.
And so this is why every other American president resisted this war.
Hmm.
Even though the Israelis have been pressing for it forever.
Mm.
Even though the plan was, okay, we have Iran surrounded in Afghanistan and Iraq, it's going to be next, and then
yes,
that's it.
So let's just finish off on the Gulf states, because this is fascinating. So worst case scenario is perhaps Iran getting Iraq and Kuwait. Saudi could get the rest, although it could start fragmenting as soon as it gets a large enough military to be able to occupy its neighbors. It could credibly fragment in some sort of way,
because
or collapse.
If the Saudis get into the war, the next thing that happens is that Yemen gets into the war.
Right.
Like the Saudis won't be fighting Iran,
yes,
or just Iran. They'll be fighting Iran, the Iraqi militias, and Yemen, meaning that they are facing a two-front war.
What's the Shia-Sunni split in Iraq? I mean, what proportion of them?
60% Shia, 20% Kurds, 20% Sunni.
Okay, so if this comes down to Shia versus Sunni, that's a real problem for
That's a real problem, because I think something like 40% of the Iraqi population is under 14. So that's a massive youth bulge there. What are you going to do with them? Well, arm them, buy them cheap Chinese guns, and throw them in human
waves. And you don't need to be a Burnham-level propagandist to get young men who don't have a lot to lose to fight.
Exactly.
What about the smaller states then? Because they obviously sound like they're in an incredibly precarious position, and trying to pick their way through this without upsetting, well, I don't know what their relations of the smaller states are with Saudi Arabia, but without upsetting the Americans or the Iranians too much while they figure out how this is going to land.
Well, let's start with Oman. The only people with ambitions on Oman are the UAE.
Okay.
They want to take Oman. That is their hope, because that then transforms them from a minor country into a major one with enormous territory and with real strategic depth.
Can we speak of the UAE as a unified thing?
Yes.
Okay.
Because Abu Dhabi is by far the largest and has the largest actual Emirati population and has the vast majority of the oil wealth and is in control of pretty much all of the federal institutions.
I see. Okay.
And so, more or less, yes, we can, to a large extent. Even though the smaller ruling families aren't happy with the level of dominance that is exercised by the Al Nahyan, the ruling family of Abu Dhabi.
Okay. It's like medieval France. Paris is dominant, and then you've got the regional counts and lords. Okay.
Yes, exactly. For the UAE, they are the ones that are most decidedly pro-Israel. Massively so.
How did they get there?
Their view and the Israeli view is essentially, if you want to dominate a region that is largely hostile, you have this alliance with the peripheral smaller powers in order to constrain the center.
Okay.
And so if you look at where the UAE is and where Israel is, if they both expand, they sort of get rid of everyone in between.
I can see that, but also an argument could be made that if the Israelis had not taken the decisions that they had taken, they wouldn't be in this situation in the first place.
Which is the depth of the alliance is reflected in the fact that despite this war being forced on the UAE and then complaining about it, officially they're doubling down in support of Israel. And the people who matter in terms of decision-making are more and more vocal in their condemnation of Iran and more vocal in their support for alignment with Israel.
Yeah, I've seen them criticize everybody, Iran,
yes,
US, and Israel.
Yes.
But they're leaning on doubling down on America and Israel.
Yes.
Because they have to, because they're small states and they'll be swallowed if they don't.
Essentially. Essentially.
Okay.
And the Kuwaitis are kind of looking like they're doubling down, but they're not making too much noise about it. The Qataris are trying to extricate themselves from this somehow and hoping that if Turkey comes out on top, somehow their own security is guaranteed.
What's Turkey's interest in this ongoing situation?
Turkey's interest in this is multifaceted. They don't want a very unstable Iran on their borders. They don't want the kind of refugee flows that follow, which destabilized Turkey during the Syrian war with a population of 20, 24 million.
So I went to Turkey during that period of destabilization, and you'd go into the city center and there'd be camps of Syrians, literally just in the middle of the street. Yeah. The whole middle of the street would be a shanty town of Syrians that had just turned up.
Yes. And they don't want that with Iran, which is a much larger population. You're dealing with 90 something million people. They also don't want Iran to be the regional hegemon, although they could sort of divvy up bits and pieces between them.
Is that because they want to be the... Do they have a credible...
Yes.
...shot?
Yes. They Anatolia and Persia are built like fortresses. And so the expanse around them is their playground. Okay. Be that the Caucasus or the Levant or to a lesser extent the Gulf.
Oh, and presumably Turkey has a huge advantage in that being a NATO member, Israel can't bomb them.
Although no NATO country is going to declare war in support of Turkey against Israel.
Right.
Realistically speaking. The level of Israeli influence over the West is such that this is not a realistic possibility.
But still, bombing a NATO country when you're not a NATO country, I mean, that does... I mean, I agree, it will probably end up like that, but that is a real head-scratcher for people who have got to try and explain it to everybody else.
Yes. It's a political problem, but it's not an insurmountable one.
Okay.
And already we're hearing the Israelis saying that Turkey is the next Iran.
I've heard them say that.
Yes.
I mean, But I mean, surely Turkey can't be the regional hegemon. It would have to share with Iran.
They did manage it in the past with some skirmishes here and there.
Okay.
I mean, most famously, Islam exists because the Byzantine Empire and the Persian Empire exhausted themselves in 100 years of war that so enfeebled them that this bunch of desert tribesmen was able to occupy them both eventually. So there is precedent for them being in very prolonged, insurmountable conflicts. There is also precedent for them figuring things out and navigating around each other. There is precedent for the Persians surrounding Basra to take it away from Ottoman hands and trying to contest that area. So
yes. I mean, I suppose we have to remember that I mean, today we think of Turkey as this sort of second world country that is trying to figure itself out. But I mean, actually, it was a great major power for a huge amount of history.
Yes. And it always was. Holding Anatolia gives you an enormous set of advantages. Some disadvantages, because around you is an enemy.
Because of the sea lanes.
Because of the sea lanes, but also because that once you dominate Anatolia, you dominate the Fertile Crescent, which is the area, which is the agricultural area along the Euphrates and Tigris rivers extending into Syria. And from that, you then expand into Lebanon and Palestine. And from that, Egypt becomes a target.
I mean, it comes back to another choke point.
Exactly. And then on the other side of it, you have the Balkans, which are fragmented, disorganized, chaotic. So a great empire can enforce order. I mean, Turkey was in occupation of Ukraine and of Crimea and of Bulgaria and Romania. Romania and Bulgaria exist as independent states because the Russians defeated the Turks and liberated them. So it is naturally a great power, and it's rebuilding its industry and modernizing its industry, and it is preparing itself to be a great power again.
I do want to come to Israel, but perhaps before we do, what about the smaller nations around Israel? So the Lebanons, the
Jordans,
the so on.
And the Israeli ambition is greater Israel. And the logic here for the Israelis is we don't have enough people, we don't have enough land. And so we will take more land and import more people from the Jewish diaspora.
Yes.
And so that requires a constant state of militarism and expansionism. And Netanyahu was one of the people who deeply understood that. His intellectual forefather is a guy by the name of Jabotinsky, who was of the view that we have to keep on fighting the Arabs until they accept that we're permanently here. And since they don't, this might be a permanent state of affairs until we break them.
That feels bold to me because they're a small country surrounded by a lot of countries that, and it looked to me like they had been going down the path of stabilizing relationships, and that made sense to me.
Mm-hmm.
But they can't fight all of them. You can't fight the Shias, the Sunnis.
They believe that since they defeated a bunch of incompetent Arab armies in 1948, which were actually outnumbered, despite the fact that they were seven armies, they were actually outnumbered by the Jewish militias. And the Jewish militias won, and Israel was established in 1948. In 1967, they beat Jordan, Egypt, and Syria at the same time. So in their minds, they can keep on doing this because this is God's will for them to return to their homeland.
And what is the temperature check in the region? Because you say that the smaller Gulf states are doubling down on Israel.
Some of them, yes.
Clearly, the Iranians are not there. The Turks must be listening to them saying that Turkey is the next Iran. So what about the smaller surrounding country? I know Lebanon is currently being hammered, but what is the temperature check around those other countries?
So in Lebanon, there's a big division between those who want to keep fighting Israel and those who don't. And those who, so it's sort of...
Is that a Christian-Muslim divide?
Not entirely. There's Sunni Muslims who think we should wait, essentially we should wait for Sunni powers to do it. And side with the Sunni powers no matter what they say. If they want peace now, peace now. If they want to fight, we fight with them.
Okay.
There are some Christians who want peace with Israel. There are other Christians who don't and fear the ensuing Sunni domination. And then there is the Shia who largely want to keep fighting Israel on the side of Iran to make sure that the Israelis don't ethnically cleanse them from South Lebanon, which is what the Israeli plan is. And this isn't new. It was the plan in 1993. It was the plan in 1996. It was the plan in 2006. And it's the plan again today in 2026.
If you enjoyed that content, and of course you did because you are a smart person, then why don't you go over to lotuseaters.com where you can watch the whole episode for as little as £5 a month, which really is not much money at all. And you get loads of really good content.